Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
So good morning to everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. So the first 2 days we've been talking about Xingang, who is this woman teacher, rather remarkable woman teacher from the 17th century in China. And this day we'll finish up talking about Xingang. So to catch some of you up, she trained for many years. It was a time, of course, of great upheaval in China, and upheaval is a time when things can happen, things can change around, mix up a bit, and so women were becoming serious students of Chan and then also able to teach, to become Dharma heirs. So she was fortunate to be in this situation where this could happen. And she was asked to be the abbot of a small family hermitage, which grew under her leadership to have 1,000 students at one point. Is that right?
100
at least, yeah. At one point. But anyway, it went from being a small hermitage set up for the daughter of this family, the Dong family, to quite a large open teaching place. And she, after years of training, a 9-year retreat, after she became a Dharma heir, she was asked to do this, and was head of this abbot, head of this cloister for 8 years. So all of this went into 8 years of teaching, and she really accomplished quite a lot, building it up, building the reputation of the place. She must have been a very good administrator to leave it in the state that she did. She's in the official biographies, they say she's known for her achievement, her discipline, and her frugality. An achievement, that's pretty clear. I mean, she accomplished more in 8 years of teaching than many, many people do in 2 or 3 times that. Discipline, you'd have to be disciplined to do that. And frugality, any of you who run an organization know that being careful with the money brings in more money. It's a worldly kind of thing, but she was good both as a teacher and as a worldly administrator. It's a rare combination of skills to have. So she was able to do all of that. Now, of course, last night I was telling the folks who were here, my teacher Genki Roshi used to say, of course, over time you get more and more experience in life and in practice and get to be a better and better teacher, but the best teacher is a dead teacher. And the reason for that is you can pick and choose out of that person's whole life the aspects that you want to preserve. So we don't know, of course, if this woman was easy to get along with or if she would be off her feed sometimes. We don't have that piece of the picture. But she certainly left quite a legacy. And then about 2 years before she died, about 6 years into the abbacy, she began to experience poor health. And she brought in, again, this is a good administrator, she brought in her senior Dharma heir and one other Dharma heir to begin to take over more and more of the running of the cloister. The senior Dharma heir was an excellent teacher. And the junior Dharma heir was someone who was fairly shy, soft-spoken, but also good at the detail work. So again, she's looking at how do we cover both these bases to keep the cloister going in a good, solid manner. And just as she did when she started the abbacy, she consulted with her Dharma uncle, a teacher named Muyuan Tongmen. And I wondered about that because here we have a whole lineage of women that have started, and that's really exciting for those of us who are women to think, hey, we can do this, you know? That's great. And here she is, this teacher, consulting with a male in the same lineage. And there's a couple things about that that are important to understand. One is, as part of allowing her Dharma heirs to be successful, she needed buy-in from the broader community. And I believe that she carefully consulted with some key male members of the community, because if they support the organization, it's going to be more successful. If she doesn't recognize that she's operating in a certain context in society, she's not going to be successful. So this is a very clear understanding of what the societal forms are. And I believe that you can fully participate in those forms in a way that you transcend those forms. She is wanting this cloister to be successful, and so she asks him, how do you feel about the folks I've chosen to take it on? So, as often happens in these stories of Zen teachers, they begin to know a time when they expect to die. And the story goes that she bathed herself, put on all new robes, and was in the seated position when she died. She even wrote a death poem, which was de rigueur for folks in this situation, have to write a poem about it. And her death poem read, "Like the moon shining on a thousand rivers, the disk of luminosity is pure and unsullied. Now I will teach by sitting in the lotus position. Sentient beings will look and see through it all. If you ask what the last phrase is, clapping my hands, I will say, it is this." So that was her poem. Basically, I'm going to show you, not going to talk much, this is it. And that really kind of summed up the way she taught. And it goes on to say that in recognition of her high spiritual status, when she died, steam came from her head. Her complexion didn't change at all for several days. She was not cremated, which is something that the body was preserved for some folks that were considered to be really highly realized. And she left seven women Dharma heirs. So there were seven women that she felt they had learned enough that they could teach as well. So quite a life. And this poem was written, I'm imagining, towards the end of her time there, just trying to summarize some of the things she wanted people to know. "This floating life is an ever-changing dream, yet we bitterly toil away the entire day full of busyness as our karma grinds us down." This reminds me of the round that we sing, "Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream." This is the feeling that I get from this. And yet we're not merrily, merrily. We're just really grinding away, nose to the grindstone, keeping busy. And She says, as our karma grinds us down. Our karma grinds us down when we act out of our old habitual patterns. You know, that's what this means. If we keep doing the same mistakes over and over and over again, they just accumulate more and more and more heaviness to them. We get better at them. We're very skilled at some of our mistakes. I know I sure am. But it just keeps piling on. And in the Tibetan tradition, there's these four reminders that we recite every day. The reminder that it is our nature to grow old, it is our nature to get sick, it is our nature to die. All that we have is going to be gone at some point. The only thing we really have that we can say this is ours is our action, what we do with our lives. And of course, the intention behind it is most critical. So if we're just mindlessly going along repeating the same old patterns, this is karma dragging us down. If only you can make a clean sweep of the cave of ignorance, you will be left with a life of leisurely freedom and ease. Again, use the form to transcend the form. Let go of the notions of how things could be or should be or ought to be or how they are. We have our ideas about things, and that's the cave of ignorance that we have around ourselves. Is we have ideas about what should be going on, or what is going on, and how, you know, if I were in charge, it'd be different. This is kind of what I see. And one of these is that issue of male and female. Some things we know, we understand as kind of the roles that we take, like host and guest in tea ceremony. Sometimes you're called upon to be the host, sometimes you're called upon to be the guest, and there's certain qualities that go with each of those roles. Sometimes we're called upon to be priests and do priest things, and sometimes we're called upon to be parents and do parent things. Sometimes we're called upon to be gardeners and do gardener things. There are all these different roles that we take on and different qualities to them. But we tend to think that things like male and female are more permanent than that. The reality is these are roles that we impose upon ourselves. We assume that there are certain qualities that attach to those, and those that becomes a kind of a static collection that we get stuck on. I was fortunate growing up that my parents were a little odd. My mother was a scientist, and she was not into cooking, definitely not into cooking, not into housework, although she was convinced that if she had time, she would be. But that just wasn't her. She loved to teach. She ran the science department of a school. She was brilliant. And my dad was quieter and more soft. You might call him the more feminine of the two. And he cared what the house looked like. And he also recognized my mother wasn't going to be the one to do it. And so he took it upon himself to do all the shopping and the laundry and the cleaning and all of that. And I remember one time a salesperson came to the door, a vacuum cleaner or whatever, came to the door, rang the doorbell. My dad had on an apron, which was frilly and covered with flowers, because that's the only kind my grandmother made, and put it on, and he had a broom in his hand. He comes to the door, and this gentleman is at the door and goes, "What is this?" He said, "Could I speak to the lady of the house?" And my dad just got this funny little grin. He said, This is her. So I grew up with that, and I have this understanding for myself that male and female is a pretty flexible kind of thing. It was okay in our house to be different. My brother played with dolls. I played soccer. You know, that wasn't done back then. That was okay in our house. And I never could understand why that wasn't the case everywhere else. It seemed to be that you had certain things you had to do if you were a boy and certain things you had to do if you were a girl. But make no mistake, those are roles that we take on. We have our bodies. We have things that we do. We're not stuck with a certain package that somebody thinks we should do. So that's a life of leisurely freedom and ease. Human life and this mirage of a world are kept going by desire. Once desire stops, all is the realm of the great enlightened one. Again, she's making the point, if we continue to be caught and hijacked by our likes and dislikes, our preferences, that's when we stay on that wheel, that little wheel of birth and death, like some hamster running around. That's what happens. When we let go of that, and we let go of our attachment to our desires, not our desires, but our attachment to our desires, then we get free of that. The lords of the heavens and hells will find themselves speechless. Having poked through the web, there will be no conditions of desire. The lords of the heavens and hells are speechless. What can you say in that situation? There's no more to be said when you're faced with someone who is free like that. Having poked through the web, having penetrated or seen through this veil that we put between ourselves and the fullness of reality, when we see through that, poke through it, penetrate it in some way, karmic conditions don't hold anymore. We don't repeat the same old habit patterns because we don't feel so compelled to. We have more spaciousness. We can feel a little bit creative, maybe a little bit mischievous, you know. Get that little grin like my dad used to get. When you're not held by that. The mind always composed and calm. That is the original purity. Careful study and accumulation of facts. Turbid worldly emotions. I have a little trouble myself with this line, the mind always composed and calm. I'm not there yet. You know, I don't know anybody that's there yet. I know a lot of people who get thrown off and can pick themselves up quickly. And that's amazing to watch. You can kind of see something, an emotion flash across their face, and oh, they know they're off balance and they come back up to the balance point. We can tap into the depth of calmness and stillness, particularly when we're sitting in a group like this over a period of time. We become calm in three ways, really: body, speech, and mind. We say silence, we say no talking if at all possible, because it really helps the mind to settle when we cut out everything but the most essential words. Really helps the mind to settle. Body, when we still our body, it grounds us physically. It helps weigh us down so we're not bobbing around like a cork on the ocean. And out of that, calmness of mind comes. It takes effort. It takes work. And we get glimpses of what it could be like to be that way all the time. And when we can when we can find that, when we know that true north, so to speak, we can come back to it more and more easily. We go, oh, I got thrown off there. Come back, come back, come back, rather than talk to ourselves about what just happened. Oh, gee, I screwed up again, you know, and this happened. So-and-so did this, and now everything's screwed up. That kind of stuff we can let go. We don't get into those storylines. She says also, careful study and accumulation of facts, turbid worldly emotions. She was very much a teacher who didn't want to encourage scholarship, I think. That's a very scholarly society there. They did not need to be encouraged to study. They needed to be encouraged to sit and let go of study. So that was one way in which her teaching recognized what was going on in terms of the context and saying, you know, bring yourself back to balance. Get a lot of reading. You've done a lot of that. Everybody here is literate, and we need to let go of that now. It can weigh you down. It can gunk you up just the same way emotions do. It doesn't mean that when it says you're always composed and calm, it doesn't mean, of course, that you don't have these fleeting thoughts and emotions. And it's important, actually, to recognize them. Can't let go of something unless you can identify what it is you're holding on to. That's a plain fact. So, to some degree, part of this is recognizing when we have these things come up and being able to let them go sooner and sooner. If you immediately change your life and step onto the further shore, your ignorance will shatter on its own with laughter and a song. And this is to some degree the kind of the heart of what she's talking about here. It's when we say step onto the further shore, that's not some other place than where we are right now. We are not actually getting into a boat and crossing a river and going somewhere that we have not been before. That's an image, but the reality is that other shore is right here. It's flipping it around and having a broader perspective on the exact same situation that we're in. This place, this time, this circumstance, and being able to hold that in a way that it doesn't confine us. It doesn't define us. It doesn't restrict what we do, because we can take a step in any direction from this time, place, and circumstance. That's the true freedom, is knowing that that's the case. We can move from this. We can move in any direction. And that's the other shore. Understand the ordinary mind and realize one is naturally complete. Ask urgently who you were before your father and mother were born. That's one of the questions. You remember that Jingang had been given to work with, a Huatu question that she was given to work with, and it became clear to her what that meant in the Dharma combat between two of her teachers. She finally was at a place where she was ripe enough that the whole thing cracked open for her, but she brings it back up here because it's a good touchstone for her. Remember urgently who you were before your father and mother were born. Go back to that deep place, that deep origin. And it also is saying, understand the ordinary mind and realize one is naturally complete. As I said, we're working with what we've got, with this time, this place, this circumstance. That's what we've got. We don't have something next door to that to work with. We just have what we've got. Realize that is naturally complete. Anything is possible from that place, but you got to start from that place. When you have seen through the method that underlies them all, the mountain blossoms and flowing streams will rejoice with you. So when you understand that this is about a new perspective and not a new situation, a new place, a different place, what a relief that is. You really do settle into nowhere to go, nothing to do. Just do this. And when we feel that way, really in the depths of our heart, mountain blossoms and flowing streams rejoice with you. There is a joy to that. That relief brings such deep joy to know you have the support of all this, the flowers, the flowing streams, the other people in the room, even if they annoy the heck out of you, how supportive they are to be here training with you, right? This is, we begin to feel the joy of working on this together and these distinctions that arbitrarily between male and female, host and guest, human and not human, enlightened and not enlightened, all of those kind of arbitrary distinctions that we make are kind of included in a very warm way in this broader perspective. So we'll continue to practice together.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.